So tonight is our third class on Zen My Beginner's Mind by Suzuki Roshi. And just as we have in the previous 2 weeks, I'm just going to say a few words at the beginning and then open it up to anyone who has any questions from this chapter. And if people do have questions, I will read the relevant section, or the person can read the relevant section, so that if you for some if you have not read the chapter, you'll get the gist. So these chapters are not very long. It's not a very long book, but they're very, very dense. So this is the third chapter, called Control. And I wanted to, just like the last one, there's a number of different, very profound themes. And the first is calling balance and imbalance. Or you might say perfection and imperfection, control, lack of control, order, disorder. He says, "This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against a background of perfect balance." So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. And then there is, of course, the topic of control. And he calls it control in the widest sense. So this is one of Suzuki Roshi's best known little phrases here. The best way to control people is to encourage them to be mischievous. Then they will be in control in the wider sense. To give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the best way to control him. So it is with people. First, let them do what they want and watch them. This is the best policy. To ignore them is not good. That is the worst policy. The second worst is trying to control them. The best one is just to watch them without trying to control them. And in this topic, and I think in this chapter, Suzuki Roshi is meaning control in a positive sense, generally, meaning command, mastery, to have charge of, regulation, restraint, discipline, oversight, management, supervision, direction, guidance. I mean, control can have negative connotations in the sense of like domination or a fear-based effort to control, but I don't think that's what he's mostly talking about here, because control meaning guided by intention. Some measure of control, of discipline, is what allows us to practice. The ability to make wiser choices, to keep things functioning, to keep things moving in a particular direction that we've chosen to go because we want to, because we've formed that intention. So then he talks about control specifically in Zazen. And this is the koan of Shikantaza, the form of meditation that we call the just sitting, the method of no method. He says, if you want to obtain perfect calmness in your Zazen, you should not be bothered by the various images you find in your mind. Let them come and let them go. Then they will be under control. But this policy is not so easy. It sounds easy, but it requires some special effort. How to make this kind of effort is the secret of practice. Then he talks about time again in this chapter. Once again, so he says, Dogen Zenji said, time goes from present to past. And Suzuki Roshi says, this is absurd. But in our practice, sometimes it is true. Instead of progressing from past to present, it goes backwards from present to past. And he tells the story of Yoshitsune's was a famous warrior in medieval Japan. Because of the situation of the country at that time, he was sent to the northern provinces where he was killed. Before he left, he bade farewell to his wife, and soon after she wrote in a poem, just as you unreel the thread from a spool, I want the past to become present. When she said this, actually she made past time present. In her mind, the past became alive and was the present. So as Dogen says, time goes from present to past. So when if we end up having questions about this and discussing it, I suggest we try to avoid spending the whole class on it. This is kind of a rabbit hole when we're talking about time and time, what direction does it go and all that. But to consider, why does Suzuki Roshi keep bringing it up? You know, why did Dogen write a fascicle on this? Why does it matter to us? And why is he talking about it specifically here in the context of control? Perhaps because we often feel controlled by time, by what has happened in the past, by the relentless requirements of the future, by the way this moment slips so quickly out of our grasp. And he's asking us to challenge our ideas about time. And then as he ends that section, he says, and acquire perfect freedom. And then finally, he talks about the relationship between freedom and rules. He says, perfect freedom is not found without some rules. People, especially young people, think that freedom is to do just what they want, that in Zen there is no need for rules, but is absolutely necessary for us to have some rules. But this does not mean always to be under control. As long as you have rules, you have a chance for freedom. To try to obtain freedom without being aware of the rules means nothing. It is to acquire this perfect freedom that we practice Zazen. So this passage is probably meaningful in any case, but you might find it interesting to know the context where Suzuki Roshi was teaching Zen in California in the 60s. So there was a movement there of moving away from traditional points of view, from dominant culture and religions, looking for authenticity, breaking free, freedom, a more vital experience of life. And so in many ways, Zen was attractive, and particularly the aspects of it perceived as being kind of like a crazy wisdom tradition, where everything was relative, the most enlightened and authentic expression was an individual acting spontaneously. And there's some truth reflected in this view, but it was incomplete. So if these hippies showed up at San Francisco Zen Center with these ideas, then Suzuki Roshi would gently introduce them to a fuller understanding of practice. So those are the basic themes, which, you know, I can say more about, but open it up to questions. If anybody was reading this chapter and curious. Just go ahead and give it a minute or so here of silence. Well, Yeah.
I just want to say, I just love the image of the cows. It just made me really happy. And I thought,
Jen just said she likes the image of the cows roaming around the pasture. It's a very compassionate image.
I don't really have a question, but more of an observation. Like Jen, I just I've been reading on like different philosophies on parenting, and like this actually reminds me a lot of one of the styles that's supposed to like be really good for kids, which is that you give them some rules, you know, and they're like definite consequences for not following the rules, but then within that structure you give them lots of freedom and the ability to like choose what they want, to have some kind of like, you know, self-efficacy within that, and that is supposed to be really helpful. So
interesting. Yeah, have you tried it yet?
Yeah.
It's in progress. Yeah. Zach.
So it's not entirely clear to me when he says, as long as you have rules, you have a chance for freedom. To obtain freedom without being aware of the rules means nothing. Acquiring this perfect freedom. Oh, I'm sorry. It is to acquire this perfect freedom that we practice Zazen. Is he saying that the precepts or other like, you know, monastic laws or, you know, rules are the rules, or the things that you learn from your experiences in Zazen are those rules?
That is a very good question. My sense is that it probably applies to the whole gamut, like, because there are what we call forms within the practice, established ways of doing things, which let us move together in harmony. They give us a kind of a container for practice. But then I was also thinking, like, you know, what about the law of karma too? Like, if you go around lying and stealing, you cause suffering. To me, that's almost like a impersonal, natural rule. So to me, it was almost like, you think about constraints, natural and imposed, that if you think you can just do whatever you want without any consequences, whether those are kind of natural consequences or the consequences that other people bring about, it's just complete delusion. You know, and I was even thinking, like, you could even say that it's a rule that, or an example, almost unlimited access to weapons of war in a society leads to some people using them to act out their violent fantasies and mass shootings. And freedom in this situation can be defined as freedom to own weapons of war. But what about freedom from fear of mass shootings? And is law enforcement free to do its job when you might get shot whenever you have an interaction with someone? So there's no, like, you know, freedom without some limits. That was my reading of it. Any other thoughts about freedom? I don't know, Tyler, were you going to talk about freedom, or do you have something different for us?
I wasn't, but I kind of, I was thinking about, I would say I'm an anarchist, and in anarchy, people sometimes assume it's the sort of like go out there and like burn it all to the ground. But we always say that the three key rules of anarchy are organize, 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 and that everything, it's actually a very well-structured and organized way of doing things. And so there are rules and there are ways that people follow, but it's agreed upon in a certain way so that we're all free. Because as you were just saying, there's freedom to and there's freedom from. And freedom to do whatever you want isn't really freedom, because freedom only exists when we're all free. And so sometimes it seems counterintuitive to have rules and freedom. But it's the way that you understand rules. As you say, not freedom to have, you know, your freedom to have guns everywhere is taking other people's freedom to live away. So it's just, yeah, or can, I guess. So yeah, that was that did pop into my head, but wasn't exactly what I initially signed on to talk about or ask.
Well, you can go ahead.
All right. So and sort of in that regard, I was reading the piece on control, and I was finding it really interesting because I thought when he was talking about controlling people, it was more about sort of how we control, like during Zazen, our thoughts and all this sort of, but then he actually goes in and literally starts talking about Zazen and control. So what does he, in what point are we interested in controlling people? Like that threw me off because I thought it was actually, just curious.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm guessing it's probably because he was, English was not his first language. I kind of doubt that a native English speaker would use control. We might want to use control in that sense, but we would kind of know that it has a little bit of a negative baggage, you know? So it's difficult for me to imagine Suzuki Roshi, you know, sitting around with people talking about how to control other people. But I think he means it in a more gentle and compassionate way, in the sense of like, you know, like kids, or, you know, like you have a community. And so how you want them to try to, you know, behave in a more beneficial way, in a more harmonious way. How do you get them to do that? That's my guess. I think was Jason next. Usually it pops the first person over to my far left. So I just
had a comment. I've spent a lot of time listening to Tim Burkett up in the Minnesota Zen Center.
Uh-huh.
And he likes to tell stories of sitting with Shinrai Suzuki when he first came to the United States. And the way Tim Burkett makes it sound like is he practiced what he preached here, and he was so hands-off that they would get frustrated because he didn't give them any rules or guidance. He's basically like, every time they ask the question, he's like, well, you just sit. And so then another teacher came around who had rules, and they're like, well, this is great, we'll follow him. And Shinrai Suzuki is like, well, and so it was just, but you know, if his philosophy is, you know, just watch and not control, well, then I could see how that, you know, to an American, that would be really confusing, that here I've got this guy who's supposed to be my teacher, but he's not teaching me anything. Like, what's going on here? So
you're reminding me of a story. Apparently, you know, they were at Tassajara Zen Monastery and everybody was discussing how they needed more rules. I mean, we're talking, this is the 60s, and, you know, there's hot springs and there's a bunch of hippies there. And I don't know, I probably would have been one of the people saying, okay, all right, we need to get this a little better organized. And then he was like, all right, fine. All right, make our first rule. You know, when you store a broom, the handle should be down so the bristles don't bend. Mick.
Yeah, so I just wanted to, like, I guess just mention something about the control thing. I really like, it's funny because I didn't even imagine it in the way that Tyler thought of it. I mean, I kind of almost went exactly the same way as Erica, where, like, I thought immediately of my own kids. And especially in terms of, like, I mean, I honestly thought of control more as almost like guiding in like a much gentler way. Like, and I think, you know, for me, when I first read this book, I was having a lot of issues with my son, And I kept thinking about how I like, I want to help him become the person that he is, kind of get around his own stuff. And I found that to be this, like, it's like a parenting book to be like super helpful, is to just like, it's not no rules at all. It's like structure, but you have freedom within that. And I found, I mean, to me, that was always what the control meant. It was never sort of like a negative kind of like puppetry thing. Yeah,
it's funny that I'm just wrapping up my podcast episode on self-discipline. So it's kind of like, oh yeah, this is another way of thinking about it. Sweet. Ryan.
Hello, everybody. I'm Ryan. It's my first time joining. I'm really happy to be here. I feel very welcome. You mentioned earlier about English not being Suzuki Roshi's first language. I am a Japanese high school teacher. And the word, I'm sorry if I'm lecturing. I do apologize for that. So the word control can be said in a couple different ways, and one of which is called kantoku, which means also to direct. And I think Mick said the word, you called it like guide, like the Japanese word for a film director is a kantoku, which also like is again to direct. If you think about what like a film director does, they don't just make the rules. They really help realize, they help all the people involved, the actors, the writers, the crew, kind of all realize this shared vision. And so it, while control might not be the most elegant word, it kind of does make sense. And maybe the word direct is a little bit more, I guess, for our American sensibilities.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. I love that.
Can you direct cows?
Judith said, can you direct cows? Yeah, yeah, you can herd them, and yeah, but control is what I mean. I even think about horses. You've got a bridle on them, right? And so like you're controlling the horse. Are you really? But you've trained it so that you give it a little message and then it cooperates. Like, you're not really controlling it, are you? Tyler.
Yeah, it's funny. I hadn't really considered it in the role of like a teacher or guider, which is ridiculous because it's what I do for a living. But it's funny because that is the sort of the wide, well, two things, the big piece about the open field to, with a preschool, I find the bigger the space, actually, the more they sort of contain themselves well. And then his piece about promoting mischievousness is totally like, I think with kids in particular, that is such a great way to get them involved in something. But it gets it gets them really thinking critically. And so more even like spiritual mischievousness might get us more engaged in kind of what we're doing. And yeah, anyway, so I'll thank you for everyone's thoughts on that. It really helped.
And I think all of this, like, we can just turn it toward ourselves and our own minds, just like not even with any translation. If we just kind of disidentify in a way with all the different parts of us, the part that, wants to daydream during Zazen, or the part that resists practice, or the part that's lazy, or the part whatever, and just think of these parts of ourselves that you have to like, all right, we know, right, that it doesn't just like, now we're gonna stop it. Now we're gonna concentrate. Now we're gonna sit Zazen, and like that. It just doesn't, so that, but if we This is like that, it's that space of zazen, like, because the critical piece is what he's saying there about, but don't ignore them. And I feel like that's often, if I'm sitting there and my mind's just wandering and whatever, I'm kind of clocked out, right? I'm not really paying attention. But when I'm really on, and if you haven't done this already, you might have, but I recommend giving it a try. If you're just, you know, your mind keeps going back to something, some worry or some excitement or something like that, you're like, okay, you know, trying to, you know, bring your mind back to your meditation again. And if you just try sometime going like, okay, mind, go ahead. go ahead. We'll just take some time to think about that now. And the mind is like, it often like really kind of cuts the whole weird pattern because it's that quality of intention that just shifts everything. Chinryu.
I don't know if we're beating this thing to death about the control, but the way I took it, and I'm making a connection in my own mind between control and the rules. The way I took it when he was talking about the worst thing to do is to ignore them, and the second worst thing to do is to try to control them. But the best thing to do is just watch them. And it seems to me that by watching them, I learn the rules of engagement with this person or these people or this group of cows, this little herd. I understand the rules of engagement and how to engage them and how to be engaged with them. And so I kind of connect that in my own mind to what he was saying at the end about rules. It's like healthy boundaries. It's not don't do this and don't do that. Or maybe it is a little bit, but it's they help us. They do not strap us down. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it helps me get my mind around that sense of like the rules allow us the perfect freedom. Like you can, you know, they're part of moving with perfect freedom. Benny and then Karen.
Thank you. Yeah. So for me, this, you know, like this part where he says, in which he says, what is it? With the right effort, doing zazen, you know? This is what I like the most in this whole chapter, because it's like what you said, just said, that if you have just this a little bit of the exact amount that you need, then it's really like helping. You're free in the boundaries, but then it's really helping. It's like zazen. If you say, for me, it's like this. If you, if I'm saying, okay, I'm doing zazen maybe 3 times a day, and then this is my rule, then it, in the end, it helps me. But in becoming more free, and in this little, in this boundary, in this rule, or through this rule, it's possible to be more free then. And this is what I'm finding fascinating. It's like the same with the cows, with the children, that just the right amount, it's like magic to me. It's this magical right amount of control or rule or effort. And this is like, for me, it's like the like a pivoting point in this whole thing. It's, and even in life, when I'm thinking, what would I like to do, but not pushing it too hard, you know? For me, it's just, this is the same as well. It's always about this little spot, or I don't know, really thin thing, like a hair, where it's just right, right, but not right in the case of right and wrong, but I don't know, like natural flow or something. For me, it's like this, and this is what I'm, it's not a question, but I really like that he's pointing this out in so many different ways and with these, all these examples. Yeah, I really love this one. It's really good.
Yeah, you make me think about, I mean, what are we really talking about when we say freedom? You think about, you know, obviously there's freedom from oppression. That's the obvious one, but this is, you know, more subtle. What is it like to be free? So see, there's other people in line, but if you want to talk about that, Mike, go ahead. Judith.
It's just an observation. So in an art class or a painting class, they have the same review. You're supposed to learn the forms, and then you know them, and you learn them in traditional classical drawing or painting, and then that gives you the freedom to know when you've come up to the edge of the form, the outer edge, and then you're moving out beyond it. Instead of everything being chaos right from the start. So, that's what I'm
saying. Thank you. Karen.
So I'm going back to, and I just also loved this sentence in the book, the best way to control people is to encourage them to be mischievous. And to me, that's kind of an encouragement to be creative. And I'm just wondering if maybe that was a translation, you know, like just like the word that we're talking about, control, being translated differently. Because I think that you do have the freedom to be creative if you're not given a lot of rules and guidelines and instructions. I think just, I mean, artistically creative, but also just like kids playing. You know, I experienced that growing up. We didn't have a lot of rules and we had lots of room to run around and what was considered to be getting in trouble, but it was really just playing and creativity, I think of. And then the other thing that kind of strikes me is where he says, the second worst is trying to control them. So he's talking about controlling people. And the best one is to watch them, just to watch them without trying to control them. Well, even though he's talking about people, it reminds me of talking about our thoughts in Zazen. It's the parallels are there as far as, you know, trying to control them. And best one is to watch them. Yeah, I think that is what we say about our thoughts in Zazen. It's just to watch them float off.
Yeah, because even to push them away is to also engage, you know? If what we're wanting our mind to calm down a little bit, right? That's what we're kind of hoping for as we sit there, that we're not going to be so caught up and absorbed in all of these thoughts. And there's another way we can just get even more absorbed if we're struggling against them. Certainly we can get absorbed in them in the normal way, but we can also get absorbed in them if we struggle against them, as opposed to like, you know. And I often find for myself too that it helps to, it's a tricky thing, you know, as a thought comes on through, to not engage it too much. And yet I often find it helpful, and this is something that Charlotte Joko Beck recommends as well, to almost identify it or label it a little bit. And I find that that is a good, that's a good inoculation against like trying to push it away. And they're just kind of like, oh, planning my grocery list. Oh, you know, thinking about what I want to do in my yard. You know, and just to gently identify that, that feels like that's kind of that, that watching, that not engaging, not trying to control, but just gently watching. Marv, you had your hand up a few times. Are you still game?
Okay, I thought maybe we were belaboring it from the art point of view. But another way to look at it, excuse me, is that having no rules becomes a rule. And I learned this from an indigenous Haida artist named Robert Davidson, who learned as an apprentice from Master Haida Carvers. And he was taken to visit an art school in Canada and talked to the students. And every student, he said talked about how they were instructed to think outside the box. And here's how they were thinking outside the box, no rules. And he said, you know, I figured out that thinking outside the box becomes the box. So there is freedom in having some direction. My two cents.
Thank you. I like that. Good story. Shinryu.
Just really quickly for Marv, what was the name of the artist?
Robert Davidson.
I was thinking on the last paragraph about freedom. And I think we've touched on this already. But if I connect it with Zazen, I mean, freedom in my practice, I think, means for me, freedom, or maybe that's too strong a word, or at least reduced suffering. Reduced dissatisfaction. And the teachings tell me, if I buy into these teachings, they describe for me the world of the absolute and the world of the relative. And if I didn't have those descriptions, how would I know where my freedom is? But it just seems to me that the freedom that we're talking about here, and I just pause and I think about it, and it's just very breathtaking how free one can feel when you don't have to worry about right or wrong. You don't have to worry about bad or great. You know, on either side, there's tension. But right down the middle, there doesn't seem to be any. And that to me would be the freedom.
And seems like, I mean, certainly setting aside actual oppression in the world, like that, the greatest limits on our freedom are internal. That, you know, as we go about our day and the way that we kind of would like to engage, or be present, or appreciate, or whatever, like usually the limits on that are our own ideas of fears, concerns about what other people might think of us or whatever, Or, you know, and just this whole freedom thing was just preceded by this discussion of time. And as you're talking about that, you know, in this moment, when the past doesn't really exist, the future doesn't really exist. Yes, we plan. Yes, there is karma. But in this moment, we are free. And I have not studied Dogen's Uji, but I did look it up today, and as usual, it's brilliant. So I just thought I'd bring a little passage for you. He says, "Do not think that time merely flies away. Do not see flying away as the only function of time. If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. The reason you do not clearly understand the time being is that you think of time as only as passing. In essence, all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments. Because all moments are the time being, they are your time being." Mick. I didn't mean to make you follow Dogen up.
I was going to say something else, but I really enjoyed the time being. There were several of us in the Sangha that read a book by Ruth Ozeki over the summer, who is a Zen priest. And it's a novel called A Tale for the Time Being. And that's exactly what I thought of when I read this last, the bit about time going backwards. It's a really, really fun theme in the book. Anyways, if you're interested at all, if that's like something that you find curious, I cannot recommend that book enough. It's called A Tale for the Time Being. It's a really fun, it kind of plays with the passage of time throughout the novel, kind of forwards, backwards. It's really, really fun. And then I was going to say something else, but now I've forgotten it too. Freedom. I think that one of the things that kind of just clicked for me was this notion of like freedom from suffering, but not just freedom from my own suffering, because my own suffering isn't really distinct from the suffering that I might cause other people. I mean, I think for a lot of us, that's where fear and anxiety is really rooted in. It's the people that we care about, am I gonna cause them suffering through my own self-interest, through the great lengths that I go to protect my own ego? You know, like all of these things that we do. And I think that's kind of that still point that Benny was talking about earlier. I think when we sit Zazen, when I sit Zazen, it just kind of feels like it's so much easier to maintain that balance of like, I can just let go of all of these things that I do that cause myself suffering and that cause other people suffering. I can let go of it and I'm still there. You know, I'm still kind of like hanging right at that point. I don't know. That was what I thought.
Well, and then you mentioned balance, and then there was the beautiful first paragraph of this chapter on balance. Let's see. This is, to live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being moment after moment. When we lose our balance, we die, but at the same time, we also develop ourselves, we grow. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is all out of balance. But its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against a background of perfect balance. If you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. I was thinking of, think of balance, think of a moment, a situation you perceive as being in balance. You know, an amazing wilderness vista, a harmonious family gathering, the high school graduation of our child, full of anticipation of what's to come. A moment of rest, a moment we can appreciate, a moment when everything feels like it's in its place. But as I was looking up definitions and synonyms of balance, one of the synonyms was tension. And balance is a very dynamic thing, right? Balance is never just a permanent static thing. You wouldn't call it balance then, right? So something inevitably shifts and changes. So in the examples that I just used, you know, there's that beautiful wilderness vista. And then there's exploitation of natural resources threatening the wilderness ecosystem. The harmony of our family is thrown off by illness, financial difficulty, interpersonal conflict. Our child faces extra challenges. Now the future doesn't look at all like we thought it would. And, you know, resisting that imbalance is another word to use, is dukkha, right? Causes that suffering. We don't want these things to fall out of balance. But then recognizing imbalance as integral to life, it's the nature of life. In a larger context, there is this background of perfection. So I think of watching those, like, you know, you watch a nature show about an ecosystem, and like within it, you know, like the lions are chasing the gazelles, and like there's death and struggle, and there's all this stuff, and there's the poor little baby who loses its mom and wanders through the wilderness, and you know, all of that. And yet, you know, as a whole, it's just amazing how it all just, you know, it's all just functioning perfectly. And then when I think it's much harder for us to view our own lives that way. But sometimes, you probably heard me say this before, but I try to imagine, you know, if my life was portrayed as a movie, you know, and then somebody turned it into a story and said, well, then, you know, first of all, then there was this period of struggle and she was kind of depressed. And then, you know, she did this, and, you know, like, it would all, as I would, you know, just be watching it, it would just be like, oh yeah. I mean, we don't watch a movie and go like, that's not supposed to happen. Wait a second, he was just happy and now something bad happened. We're just like, well, that's just part of the story. So I thought that was a beautiful way that he portrayed that there. Last comments or questions? All right. I'll wrap it up then. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Damiel.